So I went. I just came back yesterday from having taught a 10-day, 9-day retreat in Boulder Creek at a Tibetan. We rent a Tibetan retreat center called Vajrapani, and that's still very much on my mind or my heart, being there and the practicing there, and meeting with the various practitioners who are there for the days practicing intensely. And it's really quite remarkable, the experience of a retreat. Many of you here probably have been on such a retreat and know quite a bit about it. And but you know, I've been doing them for a long time, teaching them for a long time, and I still find them quite remarkable events. One of the there's many ways of angles of looking at the how remarkable it is, but one of the angles is that. That very little happens on retreat. And very little is expected of the retreatants. And it's usually an environment situation where all of our basic needs are taken care of. And people have a little work meditation every day, so there's a little job to do. But it's pretty minimal. It's maybe cleaning pots, or chopping vegetables, or cleaning a bathroom. And so there's very little responsibility, virtually none. And basically no one talks to you, except for the teachers, who give Dharma talks, and so once a day. So no one talks to you, so you're not involved in kind of complicated mechanics of social interaction, for better or for worse. And so that's not happening, so... You're not working particularly, and probably you've let go of your responsibilities at home, and the weather is basically works for people. It was a bit hot for a few days, but it still worked, and no one died of heat stroke. And the food is quite good, and your food's provided for. It's quite wonderful. And there's very little required of a person. All the conditions are basically there for our life to be taken care of, and at least at the biological necessity level, relatively comfortably. Some people didn't like the porta toilets or the outhouses, but at least we have them. And then so that's on one hand, that's kind of description of it. You know, it's quite an easy, lovely place to be. Nothing's required of you. And then it's quite remarkable how much people struggle. And how difficult it is. And it's one of the most difficult things that some humans do in their life. I mean, but what are they struggling with? I mean, all the conditions are there to be happy. Indeed. And I'm reminded of Ajahn Amaro's simplest instruction for meditation. And his simplest instructions are, let the mind be at ease. And then notice what takes it away from, what takes your ease away. Notice what happens that moves you away from that ease. And that can be a description of what happens on these retreats. Very little is what happens in retreats. And so the suffering that we have, the troubles we have, the struggles that we have, don't really come from the retreat setting, but rather come from what goes on in our own hearts and minds. And so the retreat becomes then a really optimal place to really notice what goes on in the heart and the mind. Now, many people will want... Ajahn Amaro said this interesting thing. He said when a spirit rock was built, about 4 years ago, it was, you know, a state-of-the-art meditation center. And everything was, you know, set up beautifully for beautiful brand-new rooms. And it's kind of like the Hilton of Buddhist retreat centers, beautiful. You know, everything was beautiful and well set up, and most people have their own rooms. And he looked at it, and Ajahn Amaro said, "Oh, now people are really going to suffer because they can't blame the retreat center anymore for their suffering." See, in places like in Asia, where many of us practiced, or other places in this country. I mean, you have having your own room, you know, a luxurious mattress, and you have your own sink in your own room at Spirit Rock. I mean, you know, we were four in a room laying on cement slabs, you know, shoulder to shoulder in these little rooms. And, I can tell you stories of... So the idea that now you suffer more because we can't kind of look outside of ourselves for what needs to be fixed or in order to make things well. One of the ways of understanding the goal, ultimate goal of Buddhist practice is, we could say, you know, the ultimate goal is nirvana or nibbana, except that kind of makes it a little bit foreign to us. What's that? And we could say that it's a state of peace, great profound peace, or great happiness. Mahasukha is great happiness sometimes. But the problem with a lot of these positive descriptions, like great peace, or great happiness, or great love, or whatever people might want to call it, is that it's a little bit odd to imagine these kind of states always applying in every situation of life. Maybe there are times when you don't, you know, feel peaceful because there's so much conflict in the world around you you're picking up on, and you actually feel your heart's about to break because you feel the suffering of the world. And to say, well, I feel, you know, so someone comes to you and says, you know, my mother just died, and you tell them, oh, I feel so much peace, or I feel so happy. You know, you, that state doesn't quite make sense, I think. But so the tendency in Buddhism is to have a negative definition of nirvana, meaning what's absent. And one of the classic definitions of nibbana is a state where there's no conflict. We're not in conflict with anything in the world. And we could feel our heart can break in the suffering of the world. We can feel harried by many demands of the world. Many ways we can feel that maybe we wouldn't characterize it as peaceful or happy in that particular moment. But it doesn't require being in conflict with anything, with oneself or with the world around us. So the path of practice is the path of finding that place of being without any conflict, internally or externally. The Buddha once said, I have no conflict with anyone. It's others who have conflict with me. So it doesn't mean that you're separated from, you know, human struggle, but you don't contribute to the struggle with a sense of you're in conflict with others or in the situation. So what happens on retreat is that very little happens. And in that very little happens, what people become aware of, one of the things that people become aware of is the ways in which they are in conflict with themselves and with the world. And it kind of slowly stands out. Not because we're kind of, you know, putting the screws on and kind of insisting on this, but rather to some degree, we're often in conflict in subtle, sometimes subconscious ways. Kind of the way, sometimes even the way seemingly our personality is constructed, the way we carry ourselves around, we see ourselves in relationship to other people, and the way we talk, can have at its genesis a feeling of being in conflict, in struggle with others and with the world, with oneself. As the mind quiets down, as the heart gets calmer on retreat, which it inevitably does to some degree, what often happens is that the conflict that's deeper inside of us we usually don't notice comes to the surface. And then it's quite common for people to think, oh, the retreat's a failure. You know, I came basically for vacation and to rest, you know, and retreats, nothing happens, it's a great place to unwind, and here I'm filled with this stuff. And something's wrong with me. If I was a perfect Buddhist practitioner, I would just be sailing to nirvana and it would just be very pleasant. But in fact, the path is a path of because the path is, it's kind of like this. If nirvana or full enlightenment is a mind which is unrestricted, or heart which is not bound by anything, then in order for the heart or the mind to be released, it's going to release itself into the places where we still feel constricted. So say you feel constricted about work and in conflict about something at work. And say that settles away, the mind becomes a little bit less constricted, preoccupied on the work issues, and relax, opens up a little bit. And then it encounters the next area of conflict. And it might not be about work, but it might be about some very, very deep personal sense of identity, which is, you know, we struggle about. So as the mind relaxes, as the mind becomes more and more open, finding its place of profound ease, it's going to encounter all these different things. And then the part of the practice then is to really look at them, be very honest about them, grapple with them. Sometimes it feels like grappling with our demons. So the remarkable thing about the retreats is nothing's happening. It's a place where people are kind and nice, and very, very little to ask of you. And it's on one hand, and because of that, on the other hand, it's often a place where people have, you know, phenomenal biblical struggles of biblical proportion. You know, and sometimes they open their eyes and they realize nothing's going on around them. And then to watch people, or to, you know, to struggle with the ways in which they're in conflict, and feel and see them kind of watch them go through it, and see how they can let the mind relax. There's all kinds of things that people struggle with. Or all things, kind of things that have to be let go of, or relaxed, or resolved, or reconciled, or, you know, somehow dealt with. So, you know, for example, there might be some issue of forgiveness that has to happen. There might be some, as happened on the retreat, some people had, you know, tremendous issues with a parent, and were holding anger or resentment towards a parent. And as the mind relaxes, that layer of the mind, that layer where the mind is constricted or held or preoccupied, hardened around this issue of this parent, becomes really evident. And so it has to be dealt with somehow. Not for the sake of the parent, but for, you know, which sometimes we don't want to do it then. But it has to be dealt with so that we can, you know, not live with a mind or heart that's in conflict. The problems with a parent might not go away in some ways, but it's not necessary to feel conflict within ourselves. And so that's what happened on the retreat. Someone in the retreat had a movement of forgiveness towards a parent, and it was quite beautiful. There can be people who have demons from childhood, struggles they had as children. Maybe there were impossible situations growing up. And I hear terrible stories of how people were raised. I feel like I've learned how to be a parent by all the stories I hear from practitioners I talk to, on what not to do mostly. And then children end up in struggles with, you know, trying to survive in very difficult situations. And then that struggle becomes, you know, trying to protect themselves is a way that the mind or heart has become constricted. And so sooner or later, as the mind heart relaxes, it encounters the places of some deep-held view about how life is. Life is unsafe, or I have to act always this way, or, you know, I'm not enough, or I'm not worthy of anybody's attention. All these kind of views that sometimes are found, or adopted, or learned as a child. For the mind to be not to be in conflict with itself or with the world, that has to be somehow relaxed. And so then there's a process of doing that, and there's many ways of doing it. Some people, you know, depending on what they feel is appropriate. But that's one of the things that happens. And so one of the beautiful things in the retreat also was to watch a few people go through some of these, you know, were surprised at depth of what the conditioning was like from childhood and how long they've been struggling, fighting wars that were long over. And trying to come to terms with that. There are people who on retreat who their demons or the struggles had to do with their sense of self, feeling that they couldn't be who they were. Something was, you know, was wrong with being who they were. And there was, again, a struggle of biblical proportions for one person there in the retreat about, you know, not simply struggling to be who she was, and the feeling that, you know, who she was good enough or couldn't be. It couldn't be this way, and just wouldn't feel safe in relaxing into who she was. And so struggle with that, and feeling, you know, quite happy to be in an environment where at least the environment was kind and safe, And so she could be who she was in relation to other people, at least. People weren't attacking her or upset. But the sense of, you know, struggling with, you know, simply, the struggle was simply relaxing to be, to allow oneself to be who one is. We talk a lot about on retreat and practice that the practice involves a certain degree of self-acceptance, accepting who we are. Primarily what that means is no longer being in conflict with oneself for who one is. And that happens a lot on retreat in small steps where people are, you know, all kinds of things happen. You know, we're sitting there very peaceful, this ridiculous teacher saying nothing's happening and, you know, nothing's asked of you and, you know, and you're struggling, and what a terrible thing to say. It's like rubbing salt in a wound. And so you're irritated, and you're angry. Anger arises or something, or sadness. And then we say, oh no, I shouldn't be angry. And then we're in conflict with ourselves for the emotion that has arisen. And so there's a lot of people, it's very common in retreats, for people then struggle with the emotional reactions that arise in that place. And to be in conflict with themselves because it has arisen. And sometimes a retreat process involves learning how to be not in conflict with the emotions that arise for whatever reason, and then perhaps have a wiser view on how to relate to them and how to act on them or how to take care of a situation. There's a struggles, existential struggles that people have. And again, it could be struggles at biblical levels, basically, of confrontation with death. It's not so uncommon on retreats to have someone come who has a terminal diagnosis, and maybe has only a few months or a year or uncertain how long they have to live. And so then, you know, the struggles they have, the contractions, the ways in which they're in conflict with themselves and the world has to do with this, you know, encounter with the proximity of their own death. And all the ideas what that means, all the ideas of the sadness of what they're going to lose and what they're not going to accomplish, the fears that arise, all these things, you know, have to be grappled with. They're met very clearly. And on retreat, you can't escape from them. You can't distract yourself very easily. So the existential issues of meeting your own death, for some people, looms up really, really large. And if the mind's going to be at ease, somehow the conflict with death has to be stilled or settled or relaxed or let go of. Is that possible? Do you want to? So one of the things that people struggle with is they might see the possibility of having the mind be without conflict, and then they feel there's something, you can't do that. That's not allowed to have ease. Not allowed to be happy. It's not allowed to be peaceful. Somehow these issues are so important that I can't let go of them. Because then some people feel the then is they won't exist because somehow their conflict has defined who they are over the years. Some people, they're not willing to let go because the fear is holding onto itself so tightly. And the fear is afraid of letting go of itself. So there's this struggle with these things, with the existential issues for some people on retreat. There's struggles with what we think we need to have for our lives. You know, in order to have a good life, a successful life, we need to have these things fulfilled. On a retreat sometimes, you know, maybe it means that I need to have a certain level of pleasure. One person left this retreat early. She left the retreat the first day. And so one of the teachers who knew her called her and asked, you know, how she was and what's going on. And it was too much of a foreign idea. It was too threatening and challenging for her to be camping out, which most people were camping out and using porta toilets and that kind of environment. I forget why I'm saying this, but I'll pick up somewhere else.
Pleasure.
Oh, some people are looking for pleasure, or looking for security, or looking for that which they have some ideas of what is required for their life to be comfortable, safe, successful, whatever. And somehow the retreat context doesn't provide that, and so they're struggling with that. And their heart can't be at ease because of this idea that they're bouncing up against. There's an analogy for the arising of these kinds of struggles, these kinds of stuff, which I think might be is helpful for some people. And that is, if you're going to wash your... if your clothes are really dirty and you throw them into the washing machine, you put your detergent in, and the washing machine agitates the clothes, and the water becomes dirty. As far as I know, I've never heard anybody complain about the water getting dirty. Most people are happy the water is dirty because that means the water is, has absorbed the dirt, and then when the washing machine drains, the dirt goes away and your clothes are cleaner. That's an analogy for how practice occurs. The mindfulness is like the soap. Meditation or a retreat's like the washing machine. And consciousness is like the water, what we're consciously aware of. And as the mindfulness, as the soap does its work, the dirt or the conflict that we have within us comes to the surface, which here comes into consciousness. Many people define who they are and their struggles and what's acceptable, not acceptable, by what they notice in consciousness, what arises in awareness. So then people, this stuff arises, they think, oh, something's wrong, this shouldn't be there. It's terrible. I'm supposed to be sitting here in infinite bliss, and here I'm having a conflict with, whatever. But as things move through and out, as the things that we haven't paid attention to, that have been lodged deep in our psyche, begin to move and move out, it has to move out into the water of consciousness before it can depart completely. So there's always a period of time we struggle with these things, or we notice them or see them. And it's not a failing of the retreat, it's not a personal failing to have these things arise. It's better to take it as a good sign and learn how not to be in conflict with whatever arises. Even if you have a sense of great conflict about something, part of the practice is not to be in conflict by the arising of that. Not to make it worse, not to add another layer of struggle on top of that. So what happens often on retreat is that over retreats, year after year, or even over days of a retreat, that the practice sometimes goes in cycles, where there's a struggle perhaps with something, there's some kind of resolution of the struggle, and then the mind goes deeper or becomes broader or whatever, and then it feels great, I've arrived, nirvana is close by now, and this is great, I'm on my way. And then as the mind relaxes more, then suddenly a new area arises that you didn't know about before. And so it becomes, it seems seemingly cyclic or spiral, that it goes up and down as the inner work that needs to happen unfolds. So why it's such a beautiful thing to be on retreat, especially as a teacher who sees so many different retreatants going through this, is to see that the change that occurs, see how deep the issues are that arises, and how amazingly courageous people are in meeting them and being willing to hang in there. And I'm just in awe of people on retreats. People who do 10-day retreat, I think, are tremendously courageous because it's not easy to stay there with what comes up. And then to watch the resolution sometimes. Not always. Sometimes it takes many retreats or some years for some issues. But to see somehow a greater sense of letting go of conflict. End of the retreat, people come to less conflict, more at ease, more centered, more balanced, more at ease, whatever. And then they leave the retreat and they go back to their lives that they had before. And what happens? There's a great opportunity in that transition of going back, because relatively soon, some of the conflicts that we carry with us in our lives will reappear as we go back into our lives. And it takes the form of the mind getting agitated, or the mind or the heart getting tense or stressed or afraid or angry. And then from the foundation, having been on retreat, there's hopefully, if a person continues practicing and leaving the retreat, a chance to very carefully watch how these things begin again, how they start up again. And that's considered a very important moment or point in Buddhist practice, is a transition out of any form of deeper practice, whether it's a morning sitting meditation or whether it's a retreat, to watch what happens as we leave that practice time. What gets recreated? What are the attachments that come back into play? The clinging, the tightening down, the closing down that might happen. So, and finally, probably one of the biggest, most challenging struggles in this whole repertoire of things we struggle with on retreat or in practice is the struggle or the fear connected to the very most radical letting go that lets us move into that ease or that radical state of non-conflict of nirvana itself. Because nirvana itself, the experience of awakening, experience of just, maybe say it a little bit more ordinary terms, the experience of being just being without being somebody, without getting something, just being totally at ease in this very moment, without needing to, at this moment, to relate to anything at all, or to be relevant towards anything at all, or protected from anything at all. Where even the sense of self, the idea, I'm here, or I'm this kind of person, falls away. It's so foreign to all the ways in which the mind normally operates that it can seem phenomenally threatening to our sense of self, to our ego, to the mind itself. And so the mind says, why should I do there? I'll be, you know, it'll be the end. And in a way, it is kind of the end of the ego, or is of some sense of self that we hold on to. But the cost of freedom, the cost of discovering the phenomenal potential of peace or ease or non-conflict in our own hearts, is the cost is to let go of any holding and clinging whatsoever. The Buddha said once, nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. And so the struggle is to find out if that's true. The struggle is to find out, can you live in a life without any clinging, any conflict? And one of the great places to explore that is in meditation. And to do it on retreats is one of the great things that human beings can do. So that's my little talk. I hope that was okay. I was kind of just inspired by the retreat I just left. It was a nice retreat in many ways. It was a very even retreat. It was unusual. All the teachers and other people commented, this is a really even retreat. Right up to the end, it felt like. And it kind of a little bit sober feeling, kind of being even. And maybe that's still in my mood today. So anybody have any questions or comments on that? Yes?
You said this a second ago, that the struggle or the purpose of practice is to find that space where we don't cling.
Where we don't struggle.
Exactly. But you mentioned that struggling had to be involved in order for that to happen.
Yeah, I'm not sure what I said exactly, but I might have used the wrong words here. I think that for most people, struggle is part of that process. They're struggling with themselves. If we could just let go easily, there would be no struggle. But because we resist letting go, we resist kind of softening the ways in which we cling or hold or resist, that's where because of that, there's a struggle. The struggle takes different forms. And part of the art of mindfulness is not to struggle unduly with what's there by judging it negatively or criticizing it or pushing it away or running away from what's there. The struggle is, how do I really put myself in the middle of it and really see it directly? How do I stay there for that which is kind of unacceptable for my mind? I'll stay there with those feelings, those ideas, those memories or whatever. Stay there and find how to be without conflict with that, how to let it be and move through us without getting involved, without interfering. Does that make some sense? Does this answer your question?
I was concerned.
Oh yeah, for sure. That's part of what a lot of people have to learn as they practice. The place where we're constricted, where the mind is held tight or bound in some way, is in the very way in which we're practicing to become free. I've got to do it, you know, and so we bear down on the breath, you know, I'm going to stay with that breath no matter what, and, you know, and just people get headaches, you know, or worse. So part of the art of this is learning how to bring mindfulness to our experience, but not be a kind of a bearing down, or not be a fight, or, you know. So that's why Ajahn Amaro's instructions are quite nice. Let the mind be at ease, or some modicum of ease, then notice what takes you away from that. So, you know, if there isn't some kind of ease in the mindfulness practice, then the lack of ease should become the practice, should be the what we look at. If there's a feeling of struggle or fighting or bearing down. So one of the instructions that's very useful, in especially on retreat, is to pay attention to the quality of the way in which you're practicing. So that you're not practicing in a way that goes against the grain of what the whole Buddhist endeavor is all about. Quiet group. Is this an encouraging or discouraging talk? Or neither? Yes, please.
On retreats that long, when people have these realizations, do people write notes on that so they can remember them later? Is it something that's so intense you remember? I mean, is it practical to write notes, to look at it like a journal later?
Some people will. The usual instructions on retreat is don't write at all. Don't write and read, because it takes us out of the flow of the practice. But occasionally people will write down something. But the beauty about being released from our clinging is that, at least sometimes, is that we don't have to remember that it happened. Right? I mean, if you really need to get into your house and the key kind of doesn't work that day, and maybe, I don't know if this is a good analogy, but let's just say, I don't know, maybe it's better. Maybe there's a knot, you know, if you get a package in the mail and it's tied with twine, there's a knot that's really hard to undo. And so you finally figure out you finally somehow get the knot unraveled. But you hardly remember how you did it. It doesn't matter anymore because now you can open the box. So you don't necessarily have to remember the process exactly. Some people get attached to the insights they have in a retreat. And that's another place where people kind of get then cling, be in kind of conflict, as they hold on to the insight. They can have a personal insight or kind of universal, great spiritual insights about some aspect. They think, I really understand how it is. I understand how the world, the universe has been put together. Or they have some great realization about the great American novel that they're going to write. You know, and so they have, I have to write this down, I have to remember this because, you know, and people will spend, you know, sometimes days on retreat writing the great American novel because they have this great idea and they're, you know, elaborating it and working it out. And sometimes writing it down is a good way of getting it, you know, relaxing. If you write it down, then your mind doesn't think about it anymore and you can pick it up after the retreat because it's on your piece of paper. So it's sometimes suggested you do that kind of writing to get it if you're really stuck on it. And then, you know, after the retreat's over, you read your piece of paper and you scratch your head and say, what was I thinking about? What I'm going on with this is that there's a very interesting... as the mind gets quieter and more concentrated, it tends to become more creative, tends to have more insights of all kinds. And then what happens is that people will hook on to that insight or that creative impulse, which is a beautiful thing. However, it becomes, they're interrupting that beautiful process that got them to the point of being creative. So suddenly the wonderful process has been interrupted by thinking about it, being involved in it. And actually people are much better off trusting that process that brought them to the point of creativity and take that process even further down, deeper, and let deeper things happen. Take it as a really good sign and then go further. So don't write. Just let go.
If it doesn't quite work, go on another retreat.
If it doesn't work, you can write it down. Yes?
You were talking about some people struggling, and I've been curious lately about times that happen spontaneously where some very obvious struggling against just what is drops away. In a sort of large and pervasive way, just all the struggling just drops away without being on retreat or trying to make that happen. And you're struck by, oh, this is very different. And so I'm curious about the relationship between those times that happen, which familiarly happen out in natural settings, and all the rest of the time, when that's not the case, including sitting in the sitting practice.
So the relationship between
effortless, and then of course, how to. So what's happening? That then could be brought into the rest of the time.
So what was last?
What's happening during those times that could be brought into any of the rest of the times? You know what I'm saying? It just happens sort of spontaneously.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's very nice. I'm not sure how to respond, but it seems like such a potentially complex or so many infinite possibilities of how all these things work. There are times where the are struggling with something or merely being engaged and kind of being right there at the cutting edge of practice is, required. But the resolution of some holding happens somewhere else. For example, sometimes when I have to make big decisions in my life, some of the biggest decisions I've had in my life to make, I've felt that in order to make those decisions, I had to spend a lot of time reflecting and thinking quite intently on them. But what I've learned is that my thinking mind is not where the resolution is going to come. But the thinking mind has to be engaged, has to do its homework in a sense. But I'm not counting on it to provide the answer. And that somehow, with the momentum going, with thinking and being engaged and involved, often the deepest decisions to me happen some other time when I'm relaxed and at ease. Because sometimes when the mind's relaxed and at ease, some kind of deeper processing can go on that's not being inhibited. It's like dreaming sometimes, or some unconscious process begins to move through us. I remember when I was a teenager, I used to ski a lot, and I would—I was always surprised that I was a better skier. The first day skiing at the beginning of the season, I was always better than the last day of the previous ski season. I could, and I think my memory was accurate enough, and I interpreted that to be that somehow the body was processing the movements of skiing over the summer. And organizing it somehow in the mind or the body in some ways, so that I was slightly better, so somehow I was a bit better organized or integrated. So we need some kind of relaxed time for some of this integration to happen. So sometimes resolution can happen in off times, at peaceful times, because we need to have that space in the mind for something else to happen. But the intent time was needed for some certain things to happen, and then making some sense? Sometimes it's just luck. We go backpacking in the Sierras and everything's going well and we kind of forget so much of our lives and we're relaxed and we're getting concentrated because we're spending our time looking at the clouds, just getting really concentrated and really still. And sometimes we find ourselves, wow, I'm no longer thinking about that big problem I have with my boss. Why? And matter of fact, why did I even think it was an important problem? I don't know. But what your question is also is, what can you learn from this process? What do you take from it? So when the mind is at ease, and it seems like it's almost by accident that something resolved or some insight happens, maybe it's useful to go back and review the value of that ease or the importance of having that in your life. Finding some way, I don't know, finding... finding some time regularly to have that kind of ease in your life. And that's what part of what meditation is doing, daily meditation practice. And I find that very valuable because there's a lot of things, a lot happens in daily meditation practice that involves kind of a deeper processing of stuff, sometimes on seemingly subconscious levels, touching into deeper levels of peace or ease, so that other things can churn and move within me. So I don't know where I'm going with this, but is this adequate? Or do you want to ask again? Or? Yes.
You know, it seems to me that while struggle is present, it's not the object.
Right.
Struggle is actually the resistance.
Right.
So you can have some kind of opening that's irrespective of the struggle, because the struggle is only resistance to that. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I didn't quite get it. I mean, I get it how there's resistance and there's conflict.
The realizations that come may come at the end of a period of struggle, but it's not dependent on the struggle. It's only dependent on opening up to it or letting go of something. So that struggle isn't necessarily part of the process. It's only part of the process if you're in the way. So it seems to me that being out in an environment that doesn't involve struggle might actually be a creative act.
Yeah, there's so many different ways that the inner life unfolds. And sometimes, you know, it really does seem like we're moving towards the light. And it's kind of the beauty or freedom. And it can be sometimes like a nice, easy sail, you know, towards that. And we easily let go and relax. These things arise, we just let go. And sometimes it seems like we have our back to the freedom, back to the light, and we're mostly, you know, struggling with the darkness or with the difficulties and stuff. There's no inherent need for a retreat practice to be a struggle. And I think the teachers struggle mightily to try to help people not struggle. and it's, you know, it's certainly not in the description of what you're supposed to do when you come on retreat, you know. Come and struggle, you know, it's an advertisement, come and struggle. And it just happens to be that when the mind starts relaxing in a deep way and exploring its possibility of finding deeper ease with life, deeper trust in life, that process many times involves meeting the places where we're still holding back. And then it's your choice what you want to do about when you notice that you're holding back. If you want, you can peacefully let go, or you could run away, go back to things as they were, or you can stay right in there with that constriction, that holding that you have. And maybe you really want to bolt. You really want to run away. And the struggle is to stay right there in the fire. Or maybe it's easy enough to stay there, but there's this huge reworking of the psyche as you deal with that, kind of struggle and, you know, rebellion and all kinds of things go on. So it's not inherent in the practice of the struggle, but it's inherent in the human psyche that as we move towards greater and greater freedom, we tend to struggle with that which keeps us from being free. Last one, please.
Would you say that, like, having some understanding of the teachings and whatnot would help? It seems like when you sit, and if you don't have much instruction on how to meditate, or maybe the antidotes, or, you know, methods in which to work with the mind,
yeah,
it has so much energy that if you just sort of don't know what to do and you're just overwhelmed with that, without having some idea of, you know, teachings on how to work with all of that, that the specific sort of detailed teachings on how to work with the mind in the various struggling circumstances can really help. I just got this idea of this person who just couldn't take it and left right away. That energy, you sit there with your own mind and it's just completely overwhelming. Like you said, that level of struggle.
Yeah.
So it almost seems like the teachings, you know, the specific teachings on how to work with the mind, as well as just the practice, are very important to go hand in hand there. Because if you're just like, go sit and meditate, most people are just going to like, you know,
if you just put your mind at ease and notice what takes you away from it, you know. I agree. And I think part of the strength of the Vipassana teachings is that they give a wide range of skills and understandings to help us with that. It's also sometimes a weakness, though. If you know too much, then we're always trying to fix it. And sometimes the idea of that you're in control and that you know what's happening and what to do is really what keeps a person from becoming free. And if you give people too many things to do, they're just, I know people just bounced around. They're trying all these different things. They've learned every repertoire of skills that anybody's ever taught about meditation. They try it all out. And really, for that person, what they need to do is not try anymore. You know, try anything. Just let go and relax. There was one person recently for who had been struggling for a number of years. Did a lot of retreat practice. And finally, I forbid the person from practicing. But the person was on retreat, and I said, you have to keep sitting. You have to keep showing up and being at the meditation sessions and doing the walking meditation, follow the schedule. But when you're sitting there in the cushion, you're not allowed to practice. Any impulse to practice, you have to let go of it. And I was because the person was, still trying, had learned all this stuff and was trying to apply it in a way that was kind of holding on tight. Yeah, no technique. Any movement to have a technique, just let go of it. And it turned out to be one of the most profound things, in practice this person's done. But very frightening and difficult. Some people hold on to the practice techniques as their safety. But yeah, there's a lot of things we can use to support this process, and one of them is faith. And faith is a very important element. And to have faith in the possibility and faith in the path and the practice and the goal are all very, very helpful. So my wish for all of you is that you have no struggles at all, and that you have no conflicts whatsoever in your hearts with yourself or with anybody else. So go forth and may it be so.